Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest this hour, Susie Orman, a two-time Emmy Award-winning television host and number one New York Times bestselling author, magazine and online columnist, writer, producer, and one of the top motivational speakers in the world today. She will be in Columbus this Wednesday at COSI. Go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link for that there. You can also see her new TV show, Money Class, on WOSU TV. Welcome to the show, Susie.
Thanks so much, Ann.
The book, a recurring theme in the book is the idea of stand in your truth, learning to stand in your truth. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's my opinion that the reason why so many of us got into serious trouble in Ohio, you felt it as much as everybody did or anybody did, is that we spent money that we didn't have by putting it on credit cards and only paying the minimum payment. Not truthful. We bought homes for no money down, even though we couldn't afford that. Since the bank said you could have a loan, you said, okay, I'll buy. Again, not truthful. We did so many things in the past because we were allowed to do it. We were told it was okay. We were told this is what the American dream is. And that dream turned into the greatest financial nightmare I have really ever seen in modern times. Many of you are underwater in your homes. Nightmare. Many of you have lost a great deal of money in your retirement accounts. And the chances of you being able to retire when you wanted to retire, again, nightmare. You can't afford to send your kids to school, and I know this is a very depressing message as I start, but it doesn't have to be. You really can, by standing in your truth, knowing how much money you have coming in, knowing what should be going out, all of these things that you need to do, you can, you and you alone, turn this situation around so that you can create a new American dream, one that is based in honesty, integrity, happiness, security, one where you sleep at night, you have values, you have your family back, you're all living with the same intention of honesty. And that's what this book is all about and tells you exactly how to go about getting it in the areas of career, family, real estate, and retirement.
My guest is Susie Orman, author of The Money Class. Susie, you talk about embracing the power of cash, and one of the things we've been conditioned to do over the last 25, 30 years is to use the card, the debit card, which feels like a credit card, but it's different.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, most of us, if you use a debit card, that's fine. Because a debit card is simply your own cash, and it comes out of your account right away, so you don't get in trouble with a debit card. The only problem with the debit card is that currently debit cards do not report to a credit bureau, and because they do not report to a credit bureau, they do not create a FICO score for you. And a FICO score, which is your credit score, is absolutely mandatory to get a loan, to rent a car, to be able to get a job, to have a landlord rent an apartment to you, because that's what they all check. So debit cards are fine, but everybody uses what they use, credit cards. The problem is you charge on a credit card, and you think you're going to pay it off at the end of the month, and the bill comes in, and they entice you. Well, you charged $500, but guess what? If you just pay $20 a month, you could be okay. So you decide, oh, I'll keep the other $480 in my account. You spend that, you charge more, and before you know it, you have tremendous credit card debt.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Susie Orman, we only have her on until the first break, so get the calls in early. Live below your means, but within your needs. What does that mean?
Yeah, so many times, Anne, what has happened in the past is you work and you get a pay raise. When you get a pay raise, now you think, oh, I have enough money to buy a new car. You buy a car, you have a new car payment. Now you get another pay raise and you go, oh, I just got another pay raise. Now I can actually buy a home or a more expensive home or a bigger home than I was living in. Or now I can go on this vacation that I always wanted that was expensive versus one that wasn't, whatever it may be. If you continuously spend all the money that you have, even though you have the means to do so, you never have any money to save. Therefore, if you simply lived below your means, which translates into just because you have the money coming in, don't spend it. Save it. You have to get as much pleasure out of saving as you do spending if you're going to live your new American dream. So the more money you make, if you get a pay raise, just continue to live like you were living before you got the pay raise and bank the pay raise, because it's up to you to save for your future. Pensions don't really exist anymore, and if they do, they have a good chance of being, you know, totally eliminated. Your health insurance costs are on you. Very, very hard thing to do as you get older. It's on you right now to save for your future, and you're only going to do that if you live below your means but within your needs.
The subtitle on your book, Susie, is Learn to Create Your New American Dream, Your New American Dream, meaning this is a very individualistic prospect.
That's correct. The reason we got into trouble before is we were living everybody else's dreams. We did see people who had money making all of this money in real estate, in the stock market, and so on and so forth. And we wanted to live their dream. We wanted more homes. We wanted more cars. We wanted more clothes. We wanted more jewelry. We wanted more electronic gadgets. And all of that more gave us, in the end, less real estate in terms of equity in our home, less money in our retirement accounts, less. So it's not what others have anymore. It's what do you need? What is it in your life that would make you feel secure, happy, and be able to sleep at night? And what's true for you may not be true for the next person. So stop being a cult society that you all want the same thing. Learn what it is that you need, and that's what you should go after.
I want to turn to young folks for a second, beginning with college. A lot of people promise their kids, we'll put you through, you pick the college, you get the grades, we'll make it happen for you. And now, for a lot of people, that's just not possible.
Yeah, and I go into great detail about this one topic within the family class that is within the book, because it's very important that you have a conversation with your children right now and tell them the truth as to what's going on in your personal financial situation. If you don't have emergency funds, if you're behind on your mortgage payment, if you haven't been putting money in your retirement account, if you're putting everything on a credit card, you cannot afford to take out a loan to send your kids to school. You just can't afford it. And so it is very important that if that is what's happening in your life, for you to have a talk with your children. Maybe your kids are going to have to go to community college the first year or two. Maybe they're going to have to postpone going to college for a year or two to begin with and actually go out and try to make money to save enough money to go to school. But you have to deal with them in a realistic way, and the sooner you do it, the better. Everything has changed. The new American dream, again, is one, as we started this conversation with, the standing in your truth, and you just have to tell your children what is true, not in a depressing way, but in an uplifting, realistic way of that, you know, they have what it takes to make it. They can do this, but you got to start talking to them about it.
And also talk with them once they do get that job about now is the time to start saving for your retirement.
Yeah, one of the best parts of this new book, The Money Class, is that it probably has the most extensive retirement primer that has been written in any book out there. There's one class in there that is what to do for retirement if you are in your 20s and 30s, a whole another class if you're in your 40s and 50s, and yet another class if you're actually living in retirement. Because it's very hard for a parent to talk to their children about what they should do with their money when the parents themselves aren't doing what they should be doing with theirs. So sometimes the example that you set to your kids is do as I say, not as I do, and your kids take that away and going, no, I'm going to do what they do. I don't care what they say. I'm going to do what they do. So this book gives very detailed instruction, takes you by your hand as to what to do no matter what situation you're in. It will have what you should do for you.
My guest is Susie Orman, a PBS personal finance expert. Look, watch WOSU-TV for Susie's Money Class TV special. Susie will be in town this week, Wednesday, March 16th at COSI, brought to you by the Thurber House. So you can check our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information on that. If you have a question or comment, Get it in quick, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Scott, Susie. He says, a FICO score is nothing more than an I love debt score. Even if you have no credit score, you can still get a loan through manual underwriting. What do you think?
I think, Scott, you're dreaming. You know, you're dreaming. Good luck renting a car. I'm not talking about getting a loan. All right, you can get a loan. Who cares about that? However, you cannot do anything really without a FICO score. Good luck renting a car. Good luck having a landlord rent to you. Good luck getting a cell phone. The derivative of a FICO score is known as an insurance risk score. In many states, your car insurance premium is based on your insurance risk score. So without a good FICO score, your car insurance premiums are up. There are so many more things to a FICO score. You go to apply for a job. Your employers now are checking your credit reports. Mm-hmm. They also have the right to check your credit score. Without one, they're not. What's this manual underwriting? To get a job, Scott, get a clue. You need a FICO score.
Rod, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Had a question. I saw your money class program, and it seemed to me there was something in there was kind of contradictory. You had two men on. You know, one was a younger gentleman who had gotten a college loan to get some additional training, and you said don't dare, you know, apologize for getting that loan. And then on the other one, this guy had gone ahead and gotten an advanced degree and was about $100,000.
Yeah, those two situations were very, very different. One was an 18-year-old student who had gone to school for the first time, got a loan. It was $18,000 was how much student loan debt he had. And therefore, don't apologize for that. We all need a degree. Every single person in the United States, as they get older, they should have a college degree, but not one where you are $200,000 in debt to it or $100,000 if your job is only going to pay you $20,000 a year. So be realistic on the amount of student loan debt you should have. So he shouldn't have felt bad about having an $18,000 student loan debt. Larry, on the other hand, had $25,000 of student loan debt that he could not afford to pay. So his solution to that student loan debt of not being able to pay it because he couldn't find a job was to go back to school and get another student loan. Mm-hmm. And when he emerged, he has $100,000 of student loan debt now for a job that pays him $20,000 a year. Do you understand the difference between those two?
Yeah.
One made absolutely no sense. He would have been better off not going back to school to get a second student loan. He would have been better off just with the $25,000 that he had. He could have done anything to make $20,000 a year. He did not need $100,000 of student loan debt to get a $20,000 a year job.
John from Pickerington, we're running out of time, but I wanted to get you on. Welcome to the show.
I've got a quick question. What is the problem if you have your credit card and you pay the balance off every month? Everyone tells you not to use your credit card, but if I pay it off every month, am I doing any harm to myself?
No, you're not doing any harm to yourself whatsoever. That is, in fact, how you actually build a good FICO score. Please just know that if you're ever applying for a loan and you do carry a balance on your credit card, meaning you've charged something, even if you intend to pay it off at the end of the month, the creditors don't know that. So if you're going to apply for a loan, pay off your credit card in full. Do not use it for about 2 months. And while there is no balance on it whatsoever, that's when you apply for your FICO score.
Thank you, John, for that call. And Susie Orman, thank you for joining us today.
Anytime, and I hope I see you all in Columbus shortly here.
Susie will be in Columbus on Wednesday, March 16th at COSI. She's been invited by the Thurber House, and you can also see her on WOSU TV for her show Money Class TV Special. So you can watch that. We'll have links to both of those on our website at allsides at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And join us this afternoon at 2 p.m. for an NPR News special, live updates on the recovery in Japan. Hear from reporters on the ground today at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.
39 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Partly sunny skies today and a high of 45 degrees. A few clouds tonight, a low of 34. Rain is expected for Tuesday, a high of 52. And more rain Tuesday night, a low of 41 degrees. There's also a chance of rain looking ahead to Wednesday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We turn our sights to Japan now. Japan faces a growing humanitarian crisis on a scale not seen since World War II. After the devastating earthquake and tsunami left millions of people without water, electricity, homes, or heat, as officials on Sunday predicted, the death toll could top 10,000. The country mobilized 100,000 soldiers to deliver food, water, and fuel and pulled stranded survivors from buildings and damaged homes. More than 450,000 people have been evacuated. This morning, we're going to talk with former WOSU Radio Promotions producer Emma Fett, who is now teaching English in Japan. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And what time is it there?
It's about 12:20 in the morning. So.
Well, we appreciate you staying awake for
Absolutely.
Us. Also, OSU professor Richard Moore, he's the executive director of Interdisciplinary Environmental Sciences at OSU. He spent 7 years in Japan, mostly in the Sendai and Miyagi prefecture area. He was the second Rotary High School exchange student to Sendai in 1967 and attended Tohoku University. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Emma, what are people tell us where you're at in relationship to the disaster areas and what people are talking about.
Well, I'm actually in the southwestern part of the main island on Honshu. I am in the Hiroshima Prefecture area, and so it's actually pretty far away. It's about 450 miles from Tokyo. And, of course, the hardest hit areas were north of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not in the eye of the storm, as it were, thank goodness. But there is a lot of discussion both with Japanese people and the other foreigners that I know about the tragedy and about the devastation and really the size of it. I think, you know, Japan is certainly an island that's prone to disasters, natural disasters, but the scale of this one is what's really so surprising and shocking and really devastating for the Japanese people. So a lot of the discussion has just sort of been on how this happened and how to deal with it. A lot of the backlash, including, of course, the nuclear problems at Fukushima Daiichi right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the body count just went up just a little bit ago. There was a news conference that increased the body count by at least 2,000 in Miyagi Prefecture alone. So,
Richard, tell us about the area. We hear a lot about Onagawa. We hear where one of the where there apparently is excessive radiation reported. We hear a lot about Sendai. We've seen the airport at Sendai engulfed by the waters from the tsunami. What's it like there?
Well, as far as the earthquake, it was basically the area that was near the ocean that
right.
really got hit. So the Sendai Airport is very close to the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and so that was it was affected. I've flown in there before, and the same thing with the ports that are, you know, all up and down that area. So they're mainly small towns that are on the coast that were affected, and the tsunami came in, you know, up to maybe, you know, like 3 miles in, and that was the big problem because people really weren't they only had 30 minutes to respond, and then most people weren't thinking that it would come in because there's a really good alarm system So people knew that there was a tsunami coming, but they didn't expect, it's only 30 minutes, first of all. You can't go too far in 30 minutes, particularly if you've got an elderly person in the home or somebody that's a disabled person. And then the other thing is that most people think that, maybe up to a mile or something they might be thinking, but after that they start to relax a little bit as far as their guard. So those people were all caught, without being able to respond to it, or many of those people. Some towns that were closest to the epicenter. The epicenter was way offshore.
About 80 miles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so that was also unusual in the sense that people weren't thinking of a tsunami like that. And so this area has had many earthquakes in the past, and so having earthquakes isn't unusual at all. I've been in during my 7 years. I think the worst one was, I forgot what year it was, but I remember my bed sliding all the way across the room. That was a pretty good one. And I've seen other ones where I remember when I was in high school in Japan, way back in '67. I remember an earthquake that had the water, sort of swishing out of the swimming pool, because it was like a three-story high school. We could look down and see the water going back and forth in the swimming pool. So that kind of thing, I mean, people are used to it. I've been in high buildings where they sway back and forth. But this was a whole other kind of, level. But the damage really outside the coastal area isn't anywhere severe as the coastal area. Mm-hmm. So I've called friends that are there. My field site is almost directly inland from there, but it's not on the coast. And so people there seem to have weathered it. I've talked to friends in Sendai, and their gas is off, and they're on a sort of a rotating system with regard to electricity. Land phone lines are out, and cell phones can be used. But in the area where there was destruction on the coast, even cell phones aren't able to be used, except if you have a satellite cell phone. And that was one of the problems, like in Onagawa, which really got hit hard, mm-hmm. the town of Onagawa, not the nuclear plant there.
Right.
And I think it's like they're saying about half the population. It's 18,000, about half, 9,000 are unaccounted for.
Emma, a lot has been made of social media, and I know that when I heard about the quake and the tsunami, the first place I went to was Facebook to check on you.
Which I appreciate. Thank you.
What is your sense about how that's what sort of impact that's having on the communication in Japan and outside of Japan?
Well, I think it's awfully reassuring for people that are in the United States that have family members or friends in Japan. But a lot of the problem is that the people who were in the areas that were most affected, of course, ran out of electricity fairly quickly. And so a lot of the ability to communicate, even on social networks, was hampered very quickly. And I had one friend that is up in the Aomori Prefecture, and nobody had heard from her for about 3 days. So we were all pretty concerned, but she had simply not had a cell phone that was capable of getting on the Internet or any type of phone line or computer access that could get her to post anything on social media. So I think for people who are in unaffected areas or areas that were affected by the earthquake but not perhaps by the tsunami damage that took out a lot of the networks, it was reassuring. But for people who were really in the areas hardest hit, it didn't really make anybody feel any better because you couldn't get a hold of them. So it has been interesting at least to follow now, as they're starting to get some communication back, people who are in hard-hit areas reporting, of course, what they're experiencing.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and my guests right now, former WOSU radio promotions producer Emma Fett, who is now teaching English in Japan, and also OSU professor Richard Moore. He's the executive director of interdisciplinary environmental sciences at OSU. He spent 7 years in Japan, mostly in Sendai and Miyagi Prefecture area. He was the second Rotary High School exchange student to Sendai in 1967 and attended Tohoku University. you have any questions or comments for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Emma, I know you have lots of friends teaching English in the impacted area. You have people you know all over the country. What are you hearing from them?
Well, thankfully, a lot of them are unaffected other than by the power outages at the moment, mm-hmm. and most of them faced quake damage but not tsunami damage. Thankfully, I didn't know a whole lot of friends that were on the coast. So for them, it's just been sort of really nerve-wracking with the aftershocks. There's been really significantly sized aftershocks for the last few days, and so for them, it's sort of harkens back to the original earthquake and the fear that inspired. So I think for them at this moment, it's just been a matter of dealing with the rolling blackouts, which I think is a large problem. My neighbor, actually, her daughter lives in the Tokyo area, which is affected by rolling blackouts, mm-hmm. and she has a brand new baby born around the new year. And so she actually came back to Hiroshima Prefecture with the baby because she didn't want to be affected by the rolling blackouts, which are essentially 6 hours every day of no energy for the northeastern area.
Where you're at, Emma, does life go on as usual?
It does. Even talking today to some of my coworkers, the frustration in not being able to do a lot. There are, of course, donation programs set up. Red Cross, of course, is one that everyone goes to. But it's still also very early. Mm-hmm. even donation efforts, it's sort of early for all of that to happen. This is just 3 days into it, essentially. So as much as it's hard to say life goes on, it's all that we can do at the moment. There is very much the, keep calm and carry on mentality.
We have additional information posted on our website. If you want to make contributions for disaster relief for victims of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, the Japan Student Organization at OSU on behalf of the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures, the Institute for Japanese Studies, the East Asian Studies Center, and the students and faculty of The Ohio State University. Contributions can be made by check or credit card. There will be a memorial service for victims of the earthquake and tsunami Sunday, March 20th from 3 to 5 p.m. At the Dublin Baptist Church ARC building at 7200 Kaufman Road in Dublin. For more information, go to japan.osu.edu. For the Institute for Japanese Studies and more information, you can get all of that at wosu.org/allsides if you missed any of it. Richard Moore, the government in Japan has been lauded in the last few days for its efforts and its organization. How long have they been planning for something like this? Forever?
I don't know when it started. I know when I was even a high school student, there were practice drills for earthquake. When I was doing my field work in the 80s, everyone was involved in earthquake prevention or what to do in the case of an earthquake. So that's only been refined, I think. And so a lot of plans that have been out there to help out. It's amazing when I go to the Kahoku Shimpo website in Japanese and I can get the latest news. I have them all. I brought some of them with me today. Here's a report on all the dams. They're okay, except a couple have minor problems.
Okay.
About 10 pages of every road and the situation of every road.
Already.
And then there's a report in already that just came in just a few hours ago on the damage reports and estimating the cost of the earthquake. And one of the things that surprised me in that was that the wastewater sewage system is probably one of the most severely affected by this. Of course, you can imagine the pipes under the ground being rocked back and forth and mm-hmm. So that was by far the highest damage of the air.
I'm still trying to visualize the tsunami hit about 30 minutes after the earthquake mm-hmm. in the first hit areas, and I still trying to imagine, because I visualize an evacuation, like when they evacuate the Outer Banks and that kind of thing and
right.
the Carolinas. In the United States, there's just these huge, long lines of cars moving at a snail's pace. And I'm thinking, how in the world did they get people out of there?
Well, most of it is going to high ground.
On foot heading to high ground.
And these coastal areas, Japan's an archipelago, and so you have even out to these coastal areas. And it depends on the case. A lot of this was affected the Sanriku coast, which is north of Sendai, and that area is a sort of a jaggedy coast that has sort of these high areas that come in and into a narrow valley, and the narrow valley is where the port town is, if there's a port there, or a small town that's on the coast, and so very close to these areas, it's very easy to go to high ground. Now there's other areas like the area around Sendai. There's part of Sendai that goes up to the coast there, and there's not any place to run
right.
to high ground in those areas. So it just depends. Sort of south of Sendai area, there's less of that, and north of Sendai, there's much more of that. But the areas that were really hit were the areas north of Sendai. Of course, the power plants down in Fukushima Prefecture, which is south of Sendai.
Of Fukushima is where the blast
nuclear wreck.
Or there was a some kind of explosion,
right.
and that's where there's been the most fear. But there's
yes.
five, I think, or
yes.
Nuclear power plants in Japan mm-hmm. that have been shut down.
Correct. Yeah.
We're going to take a break, then we're going to return and get your calls. If you want to call us, 614-292-8513. My guests, Richard Moore, OSU Environmental Sciences Professor, and Emma Fett, former WOSU Radio Promotions Producer, helped teach me how to do my job. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on Facebook at All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. So we'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Frank Calabrese Jr. has written a new memoir about bringing down his father's murderous Chicago crime family. While both were in prison for racketeering, Frank wore a wire against his father.
I was wired up like a Christmas tree, and standing in an area with a lot of Italian guys, a lot of outfit guys, a lot of everybody. If that wire's spotted, I don't think I'm making it back.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And there are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. You can do that at WOSU.org/email.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
40 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 45. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, a low of 34 degrees. Rain is expected on Tuesday with a high of 52 and more rain Tuesday night, a low of 41. There's also a chance of rain as we look ahead to Wednesday and a high of 54. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about Japan. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests for the balance of the hour, Emma Fett. She's a former WOSU radio promotions producer. Emma, once again, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ann.
And also Richard Moore. He is an OSU environmental sciences professor who spent 7 years in Japan, mostly in Sendai and Miyagi Prefecture area. If you have a question for him, 614-292-8513. And Henry, you're in East Columbus, and you're welcome to the show. Hi, Henry.
Hello. What I'd like to say is last Friday's Columbus Dispatch had a very good cross-section of the Earth and explanation of what caused the tsunami.
So you recommend people give a check to the Friday Dispatch?
Correct. Okay. There are two different ways of looking at the Earth. One is as a geologist and the other as a geophysicist.
Okay.
And the paper had both descriptions, but didn't really explain the difference between them. But it was a very good cross-section of the Earth.
All righty. Thanks for your call, Henry. Appreciate it. Hey, Emma, you know, we know all about tornado warnings and tornado watches, and we're kind of drilled on that from the time we're very, very young if you live in the Midwest. Do they do the same thing with earthquake drills in Japan?
They sure do. They, on top of, you know, in America and especially in, you know, central Ohio, we're very used to fire drills and maybe tornado drills, but here... even in my area, which is sort of in the mountains in the middle of Hiroshima Prefecture, we have fire drills, we have earthquake drills, we have typhoon drills, we have mudslide drills. So I think from a very young age, again, you know, Japan is prone to natural disasters. And so from a very young age, the Japanese are very used to the idea that, you know, Mother Nature is not necessarily a friendly creature. And so they are prepared for emergencies, and as your other guest was saying, there is protocols in place for tsunamis, especially as you get close to the coastline. There are even tsunami evacuation routes that are marked by special signs. So even people that are new to the area can find the blue tsunami signs and follow them to tsunami evacuation places, the highest ground nearby.
Mary from Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I can hardly stand watching some of the news that's been going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm a mom, and I could not imagine my child at 12 that... he's wearing the same clothes, and I appreciate the Red Cross, but think about it. Every mom in this nation has clothing that, you know, they don't wear anymore because the kids got too big. We all have that. I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
I did try a label like Moms, you know, Moms with Love USA. And I see it as easy. You just got to get it over there. But copy boxes, you know, the line that comes with paper,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a case. And then you could, with a black marker or a big fat marker, and you would put what the age group is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe a couple of them could be.
Well, you know, maybe we can find out, you know, where people can call for more information. Richard, do you have an idea for
Yes, I mean, I think what already has been mentioned about the WOSU website, and the if you wish to donate, the Institute for Japanese Studies and the information's on the WOSU website, and we'll make sure that it gets to the right people. I mean, I know a lot of people that are in that area. I've taken Ohio soybean growers over there. We've been hosted and dined in on these coastal areas, so I know real people we'll make sure that it gets to people, and nobody will be spending a penny of the money other than the people that really need it.
Thank you, Mary, for your call. Again, contributions for disaster relief for victims of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan can be made to the Japan Student Organization at OSU on behalf of the Department of East Asian Languages and Literature of the Institute for Japanese Studies, the East Asian Studies Center, and the students and faculty at The Ohio State University. Contributions can be made by check or credit card. There will be a memorial service for victims of the earthquake and tsunami on Sunday, March 20th, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Dublin Baptist Church ARC building at 7200 Kaufman Road in Dublin. For more information, go to japan.osu.edu, and they'll have some more ideas for you there, I'm sure. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and talk to either of our guests, Richard Moore, OSU Environmental Sciences Professor, or Emma Fett. She's teaching English in Japan right now in about probably 600-700 miles from the worst parts of the catastrophe. You can give us a call if you want us to talk to them. 614-292-8513. Richard, it's frustrating when there's been a lot of compliments from American media and Western media as far as how the Japanese are covering this in Japan and for the rest of the world, but I can't understand what they're saying, and I really wish I could. It's frustrating. Tell us what how do you judge the differences than what we're getting from American media, CNN, mm-hmm. for many people, and what's actually coming across the air in Japan?
Yeah, I think it's we're getting as people arrived in Japan and CNN started to gear up. I think the information's getting much better now. Early on, there were some numbers I think that weren't exactly accurate. But then as they got more Japan specialists to help them out, I think they were probably translating and getting the information correct. So they've done a pretty good job, I think, overall as far as getting the information to us. The nuclear power issue, that's sort of up in the air, and it's not my area, so I can't make too many comments on that one way or the other. I know my Japanese friends are very concerned about the Fukushima reactor in particular. Even the ones that are living close to the Onagawa ones were more concerned about the Fukushima one. One of the things that hasn't been brought out at all, I haven't heard one word of it yet, is the cultural significance of this area. It's a culturally conservative area of Japan, traditional, noted for sort of traditional culture, and these fishing villages, are well known for an abundance of different types of fish. I can remember when I was a high school student going out on a boat with some of the fishermen, and these, again, from these small towns that were devastated, and having them bring up the sea urchins and cracking the sea urchins on the side of their boats, and then we would drink the insides of it raw. I don't know if you've ever had a sea urchin. They're little black balls little spokes coming out of them.
Spiky things,
yeah. And they also have mackerel, saba, scallops, cod, flounder, rock trout, barrett pass, abalone. So lots of different types of fish are it's in abundance. But another thing about this general area, for instance, like when we think of the town of Ishinomaki. Now, Ishinomaki is where the largest river in Japan comes into the Pacific, the Kitakami River. And the farmers that I studied for my dissertation and the book that I wrote about Japanese agriculture is upstream from that. But they had they have a boat there that that they reconstructed. That's a replica of the ship that went from Miyagi Prefecture over to they had a mission over to to Rome at the time, and made this is back in six around I forgot the exact year, but this particular feudal lord of Japan that was named Date. It's the Date family's first name was Masamune, and sent the ship over to Rome. Actually, got him in trouble later on because they were very sympathetic to the Christians, and in a Buddhist country that was problematic later on. But anyway, the town of Matsushima, for instance, another area has a temple called a Buddhist temple, Zuiganji, which is the Buddhist temple of a Zen Buddhist temple for the Date clan that ruled the Sendai area, they were really well known because they were very high rice. This is the rice belt of Japan, so overall that general region is noted for the best rice in Japan. It's really it's the rice belt area, But the coastal, that's the rice, of course, areas are different than the coastal areas, which are the fishing areas. So historically, there was a lot of exchange in, between the fishing areas and the rice-growing areas, if you go back like 100 or 200 years.
Annie from Columbus, you're on the air, and I'm told that you're Emma's sister. Welcome to the show.
You're welcome. Thank you. I am Emma's sister. My question was, Emma, we are all, first of all, we're also thankful that you're safe. So, and we do follow you on Facebook, so keep those updates coming. But as a teacher over there, I'm curious to know how you and your fellow colleagues are explaining this to the children in the classroom and answering, you know, difficult questions about, you know, what they're seeing on television.
Sure. Well, today was my first day of classes. Of course, the earthquake hit Friday afternoon, and of course in Hiroshima we didn't feel anything, so it really wasn't until after school that that the news came through, and it wasn't until early evening that the tsunami hit. So this morning and today was my first day back teaching the kids after all of this, and in each class we spent a good a few minutes talking to the students about what happened, you know, what they did over the weekend of watching the news and their impressions of it. And, you know, high school students across the world are not necessarily known for their empathy, but these kids were all very affected. And there's a lot of tragedy on these news reports. I mean, sort of unprecedented watching the tsunami as it hits. There's a lot of video of just people standing on their rooftops filming the devastation, so it's pretty personal. So we've been talking to the students, and most of them understand natural disasters, but it's tragedy that's this big, and it's still unfolding, which is also part of the problem. You know, they're trying to work through thousands, tens of thousands of people that are dead or missing is a pretty difficult concept, I think, for a lot of adults, let alone for high schoolers that I teach. So it's difficult. It's difficult. Taihen, as they say here.
Annie, do you want to say hi to Emma?
I just wanted to say hello. And again, we're so happy that you're okay. And I know a lot of – I posted today that you were going to be on, and I know a lot of folks are following the news updates that you're providing on Facebook. So thank you.
Absolutely. Well, good to hear from you.
Thanks, Annie, for the call. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes left with our guests, Emma Fett. You just heard from her. She's former WOSU radio promotions producer. She now teaches English in Japan. And also with us, Richard Moore of the he's a professor of OSU at OSU of Environmental Studies. Richard, someone asked, if Japan is the third largest economy in the world, why donate to the Red Cross? What do they need? But the impact of this on the rest of the world must be greater than, for instance, the earthquake, the horrible earthquake in China several years ago, which was in extremely remote areas, and even the earthquake, the horrible earthquake a little over a year ago in Haiti, and then less than a year or just half a year ago in Chile. So why is that? What's the difference, and what do you perceive as the impact of losing this ground, literally and figuratively, in Japan now?
Well, it was like the again, it was the coastal area. So, you know, one thing that's affected are the you know the goods coming in and out of those ports, like Sendai. However, I mean, there's a lot of other ports in Japan, so so things can be rerouted as far as imports and exports.
Does Japan import a lot of its food?
Oh, it imports most of its food.
Most of its food. Okay.
Yeah, it's self-sufficient in rice, but that's the only commodity that's really self-sufficient in. Everything else, a lot of other things, a lot of soybeans from Ohio and corn and a lot of things from Ohio go to Japan. But yeah.
Okay. So that's probably, I suppose, good for the markets in that sense. And they're saying that the price of gasoline's gone down because the demand's gone down. Japan's a big consumer of oil.
Right. And it still remains to be seen how fast they can respond to this. I mean, again, it's like it's on most of the damage was on the coast, so it wasn't How much damage is done to the industrial structure of Japan still remains to be seen. Now, a lot of it has to do with how well they can respond to the power issues and other things that happened as a result of this. But one of the things would be like chip industry could be affected potentially, or auto industry. And there's some auto industry, and there's a Sony factory in the field site that I, but they're just taking a few days and they'll be back up and running. So most of the industry is inland. So
okay,
don't think there was a large. I think that they can recover pretty quickly from that.
What about Japan's the level of its dependence on nuclear power? Is there a lot of chit chat about that right now? And maybe it's not such a great idea. What are you hearing, Emma?
Honestly, no, I'm not hearing a lot of that. Japan actually, as far as I'm aware, has a pretty practical approach to power and especially to nuclear power. They understand that, those facilities were built to withstand pretty substantial earthquakes. 8.2, I think, was the last number I heard. And this was an 8.9, and even with that, they did follow through with all of the earthquake preparations that were made. It was the tsunami that really, whether you can argue that it wasn't planned for or wasn't foreseen, this really devastating tsunami that really did some significant damage to, at this point, mainly just Fukushima. And so I think at this point, even my casual conversations and watching and listening to the news, the conversation is more about preparing future nuclear sites for both earthquake and tsunami preparations rather than backing away from nuclear power. I think it's a very American fear to be afraid of nuclear power. I don't think they're as nervous about it in Japan, even with what's going on.
Richard?
I haven't heard from the opposition. I mean, there is an anti-nuke group in Japan, but I haven't seen what their response has been yet.
And you haven't heard people necessarily, the folks that you've been talking to, worried about or...
Well, they're worried about the
But they're not blaming anybody per se, or they didn't do enough.
I haven't heard that yet. But I don't think they're at that level of conversation. In other words, they're more of the trying to get over the disaster.
It's pretty early on in the disaster. And Emma, are you expecting influxes of people coming from that area into moving through the country? I mean, they can't go back for a long time.
Well, yes. I think most of the conversation at this point with refugees right now is just a matter of getting to where they are situated and getting them water mm-hmm. and energy, electricity, even basics. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to get to them as a lot of the area is devastated just through roads and transportation. So right now, that's the main concern.
Okay.
Once you get a little bit further advanced, whether or not they can return and rebuild or whether they're going to have to relocate is something that's going to take some time to figure out.
Emma Fett, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ann.
Also, Richard Moore, Executive Director of the Interdisciplinary Environmental Sciences at OSU. Thanks for joining us today, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the spring edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.